From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump has given William Barr sweeping new powers as the attorney general investigates what he's called spying on the 2016 campaign. Late yesterday, President Trump ordered intelligence agencies to cooperate with Barr's audit of the Russia investigation, and he gave Barr full authority to declassify sensitive information.
And that order came on the same day the president came up with a nickname for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and joined Republicans in tweeting edited videos of her. Let's start our Friday Politics Roundtable with Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. She's in Washington. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well. So the president's order gives Barr new authority to declassify any intelligence or government secrets that he chooses. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, it's significant in a couple of ways. One, it's really unprecedented. We haven't seen a president cede that type of authority unilaterally to an attorney general in that way. It's not just DOJ documents that could be involved here, but all the intelligence agencies, as you mentioned. And it's also really significant because we know Attorney General Barr has, for the most part, really been echoing the White House when it comes to this claim that there was something nefarious going on or potentially nefarious going on that started this Russia investigation. The president calls it a witch hunt. He has said that he was spied upon, and Attorney General Barr himself used that word, spying, when talking to congressional investigators about it and saying that there's a need to get to the bottom of it. So I've talked to some national security experts, and the fear is, especially given the way Attorney General Barr, when the Mueller report came out, he sort of preempted the messaging on that, saying, again, essentially that there was no obstruction, and really classifying it in a way that folks and on Robert Mueller's team didn't agree with, that the attorney general now may choose to pick and choose what he orders declassified to paint a picture that is favorable to the one that the claim that the White House is making.
Well, on Fox News this morning, the Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham, an ally of the president, defended his move to investigate the investigators. Let's listen.
I want to make sure we have some rules that you just can't open up a counterintelligence investigation on a presidential candidate without having a good reason.
Kimberly, what kind of position does this put the intelligence agencies in?
It can be a tough position. I mean, it is up to the intelligence agency to follow the rules and the orders as set out by the president, but it is also the role of the intelligence agency, people within that community, to protect confidential sources, to protect methods, and to really protect the integrity of not just this investigation, but other investigations that could be ongoing. So it could be a rock in a hard place if these officials find themselves acting in a way that they might believe is more politically motivated than an actual attempt to get to the bottom of an investigation to make sure that no rules were broken.
Kimberly Atkins, where are we on the war of words between President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi? Here's President Trump at the White House event yesterday.
Crazy Nancy. I tell you what, I've been watching her, and I have been watching her for a long period of time. She's not the same person. She's lost it.
That was after Pelosi accused Trump of storming out of their meeting on infrastructure earlier this week. Here's Pelosi.
I pray for the president of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country.
And then the president tweeted out a video making fun of how Pelosi speaks. It just makes me think, if someone in America did that to a coworker, they'd be fired. Why doesn't anybody in Trump's party stand up to him on this stuff?
Yeah, and let's be clear. The video that was tweeted out was altered. It was this sort of cut together to try to make it seem that she was having speech problems that she wasn't actually having. But yes, it's really it's remarkable in a way. In another way, it's not. We have seen this president give nicknames to his political adversaries. It's actually remarkable that Nancy Pelosi has gone this long without one, and he seems to be trying one out, although he seemed to indicate that he didn't love it, so maybe another one will be forthcoming. But this president also tends to hit back with the same accusation that he is being hit with. So with Nancy Pelosi suggesting that he was losing his temper, perhaps that someone needs to stage an intervention, it is not surprising that the president is making similar claims about Nancy Pelosi and her capacity with respect to these videos. I mean, anybody in Washington who has been to the Hill and has seen Nancy Pelosi in action, there does not seem to be any mental or other weakness that is notable, but that's where the president's going now.
Kimberly, we've been trying to find time all week to talk about Ben Carson and this confrontation he had on Capitol Hill earlier in the week. Here's an exchange with Democrat Katie Porter.
I'd also like you to get back to me, if you don't mind, to explain the disparity in REO rates. Do you know what an REO is?
An Oreo?
No, not an Oreo. An REO. REO.
Real estate?
What's the O stand for?
E-organization.
Owned. Real estate owned. That's what happens when a property goes to foreclosure. We call it an REO.
Okay, so that's an awkward situation for the housing secretary to be in. Carson later tweeted a picture of himself with Oreos offering to send some to Porter, but he was also in hot water, accused of not being truthful about the administration's plans to change Obama-era protections for homeless transgender people. Not a good week for Ben Carson.
It is not. I mean, he's been on the job for 2 years, more than 2 years now. So to not know basic terminology with respect to something as important as foreclosure rates was not a particularly good look for him. But also, yes, this transgender rule, he said that was not up for change. And we now know that it is. And it's a big issue. Democrats and LGBTQ advocates are really speaking up about this, saying that this rule could do things like prevent transgender individuals from being housed in federally funded homeless shelters, and it can put them in danger. Remember that transgender individuals are already more likely to be homeless. They're more likely to face assault and other crimes. So it's a big issue.
That's Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent at WBUR. Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's bring in Paul Steinhauser, who covers 2020 politics in New Hampshire, the first in the nation primary state. He's in Concord. Paul, let's talk about some of the 2020 news of the week. How closely are New Hampshire voters paying attention at this point to the race for president?
Well, very closely, actually, more than you'd be surprised. You know, this is the first in the nation primary state, so voters here are pretty they're pretty clued into what's going on, and you've really seen a lot of activity over the last 6 months since late last year, and especially at the start of this year. So, yeah, the candidates are here. They're making the rounds. They're coming on repeated trips, and the voters are definitely plugged into all the things that are happening. You guys were just talking about, you know, all the activity in Washington. Remember, a bunch of the 24 contenders for the Democratic nomination are members of Congress.
Right. So they've got to be back there for some of these things, I guess.
Yeah. But Sanders, Harris, Warren, Klobuchar, Booker, and Gillibrand all in the U.S. Senate. And also all of them, or most of them, weighing in on these calls for impeachment. Some of them extremely supportive of the beginning impeachment proceedings. Some, like the two at the top, former Vice President Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, both kind of not advocating for impeachment hearings to begin right now. But Sanders may be changing his mind, saying just 2 days ago that it may now be time for those hearings to begin.
How about Pete Buttigieg, who made headlines yesterday for saying at a Washington Post event that the president faked a medical deferment to get out of going to Vietnam? Here's that.
I have a pretty dim view of his decision to use his privileged status to fake a disability in order to avoid serving in Vietnam.
You believe he faked a disability?
Do you believe he has a disability?
Yeah.
Yeah. At least not that one.
Buttigieg, of course, is a vet. He has served. How's he doing, resonating there in New Hampshire?
Resonating quite well. He had some large crowds the last time he was here. He's coming back just in a few hours, actually, for another visit. Interesting there. And that was the lead. Besides writing for the local newspapers here in New Hampshire, I also write nationally for Fox News. And that was my lead on for Buttigieg yesterday. This storyline has come up in the past about Donald Trump then getting 4 college deferments and then a medical deferment, and whether he really truly had bone spurs in his heels. This has been a story for quite some time. But for Buttigieg to weigh in on it, it was interesting because, of course, he's only one of a very few number of veterans who were running for the White House. That's why it made a lot of waves.
You know, I was in Kentucky this week and talking to some voters there, and many of them were very interested in Joe Biden on the Democratic side. And I wondered how much of that is just because at this point in the race, many voters aren't paying that much attention to what's going on. And they know Joe Biden. That's just a name that they know. And they know what he's about. They know he has experience.
It's a good point. Listen, we still have a little over 8 months to go until the voting begins in Iowa, then New Hampshire and the other early voting states. So at this point in a cycle, an election cycle, name recognition matters a lot still. Even though this race has been going on for a while, name recognition matters a lot because not everybody's plugged in yet. Joe Biden has tons of name recognition. Here's another reason, though, why he is the clear front runner in all the polls nationally and in the all-important early voting states. It's because of electability. Right now, most Democratic voters perceive that he's the best chance to beat Donald Trump, and they desperately want to do that. Mm-hmm. That's the top item for them. That's why Biden's on top right now. He's running a general election type campaign in the primaries, but the debates start next month, and then he's going to have to deal with his competitors.
The debates start next month.
We will
month.
Be watching.
Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire-based national political reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lawmakers in Connecticut are looking to pass a first-in-the-nation bill that would allow prisoners to make free phone calls to the outside world. Supporters of the legislation say right now the calls are expensive, and that makes a difficult situation even harder for prisoners and their families. Connecticut Public Radio's Lori Mack reports.
This is a prepaid collect call from an inmate at Hartford Correctional Center.
This is how a typical call from a Connecticut State Correctional Facility begins. Once the call is accepted, you get 15 minutes to talk, and it'll cost you about $5. That's the second highest rate in the nation for in-prison phone calls. It can add up quickly for the families who are often the ones footing the bill through a prepaid account. Brittany Kane is program coordinator for the Connecticut Children with Incarcerated Parents Initiative. She says the fees can be devastating for low-income families trying to maintain relationships with loved ones who are incarcerated.
We don't have bus lines to these prison facilities. We don't have transportation vouchers for families who don't have a car or can't afford gas money. So these calls mean the world.
And for the kids with incarcerated parents, Kane says contact can have a significant impact.
For a child to talk to their parent and say, hey, I got an A on my test. Hey, I won my basketball game. You know, these are the things that these children want to talk to their parents about. It's for the kid to feel, you love me, and I'm here for you, and you're going to be here for me, whether from afar or in my house.
A bill introduced earlier this year by State Representative Josh Elliott would make prison calls free. The measure has garnered support on both sides of the aisle, but the biggest hurdle, says Elliott, is the cost.
It's about $7 million that we estimate will be a loss to the state. So basically what happens is Securus, who is a private company, contracts with the Department of Corrections. They come in and administer the phone system. They take a certain amount of profit and they kick back a certain amount to the DOC.
In all, families paid about $15 million to receive phone calls from their loved ones behind bars last year. About half of that went to the state. The judicial branch says the revenue is used for criminal justice programs, probation officer positions, and other related expenses. And the loss of funds concerns lawmakers like Republican Representative Craig Fischbein. He does not support the bill, but he says he has mixed feelings.
Somebody has to pay for this service to be rendered. On the other hand, if people only knew that the state of Connecticut is profiting from communications between family members and those that are incarcerated, I think that is absolutely horrible.
Advocates say that if inmates don't have an emotional support system, that ends up costing the state more money in the long run. Brittany Kane says studies show that maintaining ties with loved ones can improve reentry back into the community after incarceration and helps lower recidivism.
So if we're spending, you know, about $58,000 a year per incarcerated person, why don't we make it fruitful for all of us? And we know they're returning to society. So let's do what we can to rehabilitate and not be punitive. And so let's foster these relationships.
Marlene Torres is from Hartford. Her older brother was incarcerated when she was a child. She says she was only able to talk to him for a couple of minutes, maybe once a week, because her family couldn't afford the phone calls. She's now 28 years old and still recalls the painful feeling of abandonment by the brother she looked up to.
I think I hated him for a while, but it was more an abandonment. My dad was there, but that was my brother. I mean, we never talk about it. I think that's what it is. I wish if it was more different, like I could talk to my brother every day, I think it would have been changed a lot.
The prison phone call measure was not included as part of the $43 billion spending plan recommended by the Appropriations Committee. But advocates like Representative Josh Elliott are holding out hope since the session doesn't end until June.
Before January of this year, this wasn't even a conversation in Connecticut. Even if it doesn't become law this year, we've still gotten very far with what is essentially a new idea and a paradigmatic shift in the way that we administer telephone calls.
New York City passed a law last year, making it the first city to eliminate telephone charges for incarcerated people. It went into effect this month. Connecticut is a state lauded for its forward-thinking policies in criminal justice. If the measure passes here, it would become the first state to make prison calls free. For Here and Now, I'm Lori Mack in Hartford.
The theme song to the classic sitcom The Jeffersons, performed by Jennifer Hudson on ABC's Wednesday Night Special. She was one of many star actors tapped for a live restaging of The Jeffersons and All in the Family. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans was watching. Eric, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great.
All right, great. So ABC this week tried an experiment with this live redo of All in the Family and The Jeffersons. Let's hear some more of it. Jamie Foxx here playing the iconic George Jefferson showed us exactly how live it was.
Ever since I was a little boy, I would always beg my mother for a little brother. But you know, we were broke. So it's live. Everyone sitting at home just think their TV just messed up.
I love that. He just breaks out of character entirely. You think, Eric? All-star cast, by the way.
Yeah, all-star cast. Well, it worked out well for ABC. They drew over 10 million viewers, and it was the number one show on network television that evening. So I expect that we're going to see more of this. It seemed to get generally positive reviews. I was a little more mixed because I grew up with these shows. And as great as Woody Harrelson and Jamie Foxx are as performers, they're not Sermon Hemsley and Carol O'Connor.
Yeah.
And so there was something missing there for me, because once you see other actors do those lines, you realize that so much of the humor in the lines that they were given was what the performers did with it. And Jamie Foxx is amazing, but he was basically doing a bad Sermon Hemsley impression, and Woody Harrelson wasn't even trying to do an impression of Carol O'Connor.
Yeah.
So it was a little weird. But it was, for people who are nostalgic for the show, I think a lot of people enjoyed it. It got rave reviews on social media, and mostly I saw critics seem to like it.
And it seems like the actors actually tried very hard to be faithful to the original script. Do you think that was a mistake?
Well, I think changing it by tweaking it would have been an even bigger mistake. At least they could say, hey, we're doing the scripts the way they were originally done, to see what they sound like to modern ears. And I think for the most part, it kind of translated. There were several jokes that I think referenced people and politicians that folks don't necessarily know right now, especially younger people. But, you know, the way Archie talked about people of color and talked about Jewish people and all of that, you know, everybody knows that character is a bigot with
– he was racist, right? Yeah.
Is a bigot who was bigoted because he was ignorant, you know? I think the important thing about Archie Bunker was that he was a bigot because he didn't know any better. And I would fault Woody Harrelson a little bit in not being that sort of – bringing out that lovable side of the character where you might – excuse some of the things he's saying because, he's like your crazy uncle. He just doesn't know any better. But everybody else in the show treats, Archie that way. And so I think he comes off that way anyway.
We mentioned the star power. Why do you think these types of projects draw such big names?
I think for the actors, it's a tremendous challenge, to go in and nail something like this live. And I think you really saw the difference between sitcom veterans and actors who weren't necessarily sitcom veterans. You know, Sean Hayes came in and had one scene and nailed it.
My best friend was my nanny. Wonderful woman, nanny. She'd tell me fairy tales for hours, and I would sit in her lap and pull the hairs out of her chin.
He is so used to, working in the sitcom environment. I think one reason Jamie Foxx did better portraying George Jefferson is because his early days in show business were spent in sitcoms and in these kind of sketch shows. Mm. Marissa Tomei stepped up really well. I thought she did a great Edith Bunker.
Edith, look at this toast. It's stone cold.
Oh, I'm sorry, Archie. It was warm when I made it.
That would have been a good time to serve it to me then, huh?
No, you weren't awake then.
But for me, again, I'm a little harsher on this than some of the critics. I felt like a lot of the, Ike Barinholtz and some of the other actors, they were cool, but I wasn't particularly impressed with them. But I think Starz wanted to do it because it was a cool project. It was something that no one had done before. You knew it was going to get a lot of attention. And there's a lot of affection for both of these shows out there.
As you say, ABC got some praise for this project, but it looks like they've been struggling overall. The network season TV numbers are out. And ABC's ratings are down. Do you think that this is an answer to try to solve that problem?
Well, definitely. ABC has been in flux. Once Disney bought big parts of Fox, they imported some of the people who ran their television division and put them in charge of ABC's, Disney's TV division. And so it's not a surprise that their ratings might have been hurt because they weren't able to focus on the shows necessarily, and that they would try a project like this as a way to figure out some new things they could do that maybe ABC hadn't been considering before. ABC is down, NBC is on top, even though they didn't have the Olympics or the Super Bowl, which is kind of interesting. Now, ABC is also a network that doesn't have football. It's the only network that doesn't have NFL football games. And I think that also affected their ratings because all the other networks did better in 18 to 49, and sports can help a lot with that.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
There will be a new prime minister in Great Britain this summer. Theresa May announced today she will step down June 7th, after failing to achieve her overriding goal, leading the UK out of the European Union, or Brexit. May's Conservative Party says a new leader will be in place by the end of July. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jeremy. We hadn't spoken for a while. I thought you'd sort of given up on me or given up on the UK.
And yet here we are in pretty much the same place, still no plan for Brexit. But what does Theresa May's exit mean for Brexit?
I think this is a grave moment for the UK. I think it means several things. I mean, I think there's still a complete uncertainty about Brexit. I think it means whoever takes over from her will inherit a Conservative Party more divided than when she took office. Very worryingly, I think a country even more polarised than 3 years ago when she came into number 10 Downing Street. And I think this makes very heavy going for whoever succeeds her. An international community which I think has made up its mind that Brexit is kind of crazy.
But what about in Britain? It looks like the Conservative leader could well be Boris Johnson, who's more of a hardcore Brexiteer. The Conservatives are going to have a leader who really knows what he wants, which is to leave, maybe even with no deal. Is that more likely now?
Yes, I think it is. And I guess to combine answering your first question with this one in terms of, what happens next. So absolutely, Boris Johnson is a contender. I think either way, whether it's him or one of the others, I think it's going to be a bruising and ugly contest. I think whoever emerges, whether it's Mr. Johnson or someone else, will be someone who is really, really committed to Brexit. And absolutely, I suspect what happens next is there'll be an attempt at a renegotiation with the European Union. That won't work, which means that come October the 31st, Britain will be looking at either, it seems to me, a no-deal Brexit with all of the sort of economic uncertainty that would come with that, or a complete sort of political breakdown and the need for a general election.
Well, and what about the people on the other side? Is there any momentum at the moment for those who don't want a Brexit at all, or where do they go from here?
Very much so. And here's the problem that whoever takes over from Theresa May will face. And some of this, of course, is Theresa May's making, and I think it's the worst part of her legacy. What has happened in the last 3 years is that people have really entrenched. The country has become more polarized. That's reflected in the politics. So those who were in favor, vaguely, of Brexit, they now want to leave with no deal. Whereas those who were on the Remain side during the referendum, both in politics and beyond, think Brexit is proving just as nutty as we'd feared, and they are more adamant than ever that it should be stopped. So that is why I say this is a grave moment for Britain. Its main political parties are in absolute chaos, and the country is deeply divided. I mean, I don't want to sound overdramatic, but I've said to you before, Jeremy, that this is the most profound political crisis that Britain has faced since the Second World War, and I think, if anything, it's just deepened.
Do you think there are any people in the UK right now who wish that your political system was more like ours and you could have a leader that comes in and just does what they want instead of having to pass things through Parliament when nobody can agree on anything?
That is a fascinating question. I don't think anyone's put it quite like that, Jeremy. But if you ask people, would you like somehow Brexit to go away and not have to hear that word, not to have to hear any of these politicians, to not have to hear people like me banging on the radio, they'd say, yes, please, hang on, Rob, where do we sign up?
No. Everybody wants to hear from you, Rob. That's the best part about Brexit. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Raul Campos is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us now. Hi, Raul.
Hola, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I think that for the first time in a long time that it's actually been warmer here where I am in the Northeast than it is where you are, because I know you guys have had a little bit of a cold spell in Southern California. So I'm sorry about that. I'm sure you have a real appreciation for what we've been through over the winter.
You know, it's all good. It's such a rarity, though. You know, I'm born and raised in L.A.
Yeah.
And to just see this kind of like cold climate and wet weather, you know, in towards the end of May, it's unheard of.
Well, you get into June gloom, so that's coming right up.
A little early.
now, is there a theme that goes along with the music that you've brought us today?
You know, lately I've been kind of on this kick of like collaborations and just the mixing of genres and even languages, as we're going to check out with a couple of these tracks.
Okay, well, let's listen to the first one. This is by Pix. This is called Andean Condor. So this song is about a condor, as in the bird of prey. What do you think Pix is trying to say here?
Well, it's definitely, in addition to being fun and poppy and happy and dancey, which was the first thing that kind of attracted me, was kind of that old school kind of almost a drum and bass feel. But then getting into the lyrics, it's like, why the Andean condor? And listening a little more into it, it's more about the pecking order. And she tends to get a little political. And here, I think it's definitely getting into the kind of the whole man versus woman and kind of the hierarchy in all the different genders. So the whole inequality and talking about like, no, you're going to dance for me, boy. It's kind of like a cool line in the mm-hmm. song.
And tell us more about Pix.
Well, she's a youngster. She's 23, British artist, and I like her fusion. She definitely mixes up the electronic elements with the indie rock and even a little grunge rock. So I've been a fan of her since like the first few songs that I've heard of hers.
Okay, the next one you wanted us to hear is by Quantic. This is called You Used to Love Me.
Let's go down to the lady in red, see what she's gotta say.
It's interesting. Some of the notes don't go exactly where I think they're going to go, but it works anyway.
Well, that's Quantic. Will Holland, he's kind of one of those chameleons that we've been big fans of at KCRW, and me personally, specifically, since day one, since I first met the guy at, wow, something like maybe 15, 20 years ago. He's a fantastic DJ producer out of the UK, and this guy's done every kind of genre from soul to Latin to, you know, cumbias and different salsa songs, and of course, the electronic element in this one. Now you're hearing a little more of the kind of the jazz element. So what you're talking about, maybe some of those notes wouldn't necessarily go where you're expecting it to go. It's kind of a flip.
Okay, well, let's get to the next one. This is by Rye. This is called Needed To.
Why you sound so silent? Why you feel so sad?
Be a perfect song for your breakup playlist, Raul. What do you think?
Well, I mean, everything that these guys do is just sexy and beautiful, even when it is kind of like a breakup song. And just the vocals of Milos, they're always just on point. He's just a breathtaking singer. And when you put the beats of Itai Shapiro, who's kind of the collaborator, the producer, and even going way back when they were getting produced by Robin Hannibal of the band Quadrin, and he's got a bunch of different other projects themselves, it's just a beautiful fusion. And then they just dropped this EP called Spirit, and all the songs on the EP are just gorgeous.
Okay, well, if that was a breakup song, the next one could be the song for your rebound. This is Girl Ultra with Dame Love.
I won't tell you twice or more. Feelings always come and go. Si lo quieres, dámelo. Feelings always come and go. Si lo tienes, dámelo. There's something about you, something. There's something. There's something about you, something. There's something.
So sultry, Raul.
Beautiful, right? And again, it's the collaboration. Girl Ultra, artist from Mexico City, and Kuko here from LA, kind of both young phenoms. And the way they're just meshing their vocals and even going back and forth from Spanish to English is kind of a cool thing lately, where you're seeing that kind of pop up a lot with bands like Oso Motley, La Santa Cecilia, Cali Uchis.
Well, in fact, Dame Love, it looks like it would be pronounced Dame Love. But in this case, they're saying it Dame Love. That's the sort of Spanish to English back and forth.
Yeah, and it's basically give me love. And it does sound like, you know, it's one of these cool kind of happy relationship song where I can, like, just bury my head in your shoulders and in your arms and just take a long cruise. And even in the video, they kind of exemplify that where it's like they're just cruising through the desert and just kind of chilling in this nice cruise.
Okay, let's get to the last one. This is Ra Ra Riot with Flowers.
Do I want a sundance in Southern California? When the sun shines, if it don't shine for you. Now I'm making bread again, still living in a rental. You're in our old house, and it makes me sentimental. I could get you on the line, but I know. My only medicine is letting go again.
So Ra Ra Riot came out of Syracuse, New York in 2006. How did you first hear about them?
again through different DJs at KZRW, where we all kind of bounced back and forth. And when they came on the scene and then they came through the station, I was definitely glued to their vibe and their sound. And they're celebrating, you know, the 10th anniversary of their first album. And, you know, when you put somebody like Rostem into the mix with them, of course, of Vampire Weekend and Maggie Rogers and a couple other projects to kind of co-produce this song, and just this homage to LA and California and the sunshine, and obviously, you know, living out here with the pros and cons. It's kind of cool to hear that expressed in the lyrics.
You know, you hear so much music from KCRW DJs, which we try to bring on the DJ sessions. And I will tell our listeners right now that over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be hearing interviews with both Rufus Du Sol and Christine and the Queens, two
awesome
groups that KCRW has been playing for a long time.
You know, it's the family of DJs at KCRW, where we all kind of feed off of each other.
Okay, well, we are so glad to have you as part of this show. Raul Campos at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The United States Postal Service wants driverless trucks to deliver your mail. The agency is in a 2-week testing program to carry mail more than 1,000 miles from Dallas to Phoenix and back in self-driving trucks. The vehicles were developed by the San Diego startup Too Simple. Chuck Price is chief product officer for the company, and he joins us now. Chuck, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How are things going? Have you delivered any mail yet?
We have. We've completed our first runs, and our second runs are underway right now. And so far, we are ahead of schedule.
And tell me how it works.
We're operating from both directions at the same time. So we have vehicles leaving both Dallas and Phoenix simultaneously, driving the entire 1,000-mile route each way. While the vehicle's operating autonomously, we still have to monitor with a safety team. So we have relay teams of drivers along the route, and periodically the vehicles stop. We swap the drivers and safety engineers and continue along the way.
Are these big semi-trucks? So tell me more about the equipment that you're using.
Yes, these are 18-wheelers. They are Peterbilt tractors, Peterbilt 579s, pulling a 53-foot Postal Service trailer.
Okay, so the Postal Service says that self-driving trucks could help solve a big issue, which is a shortage of drivers that the entire industry is facing. What do you think about that? Could what you're doing help?
Yes, indeed. In particular, this kind of run is what we consider the sweet spot for autonomy, because it normally requires a team of drivers. And that's one of the hardest kind of routes to recruit drivers for, because they have to ride together, operate as a team, run day and night for multiple days. This is something that is very well adapted for autonomy.
Do you think that you'll get to the point one day where there is no human in the cab to make sure things don't go wrong? I mean, will there really be an empty truck driving mail from Dallas to Phoenix?
Yes, we believe this will happen very soon. We're expecting to achieve our first commercial driver out operation by the end of 2020, or
wow,
perhaps early 2021.
And what about the 3.5 million truck drivers in this country who are in the cabs of trucks? Could this eventually disrupt their jobs?
We believe that current truck drivers are quite secure. We don't believe that this will disrupt existing jobs. We believe that this will supplant what is currently a very significant driver shortage. Today, there are 50,000 drivers missing from the system. By 2024, it is projected to be upwards of 175,000 to 200,000 drivers shortage.
Hmm. And what about money? It's no secret the USPS, the Postal Service, is losing a lot of money. In 2018, they had a net loss of $3.9 billion. Is this a solution for stretched budgets at places like the Postal Service?
It very much is. This type of technology saves dramatically on the operating cost of operating a vehicle. It's also very fuel efficient. So we save fuel, And that has, of course, multiple benefits. It saves you money and it saves the environment.
The trucks that you're using are going to spend a lot of time on the interstate. I guess those are easier to navigate if you're in a big semi-truck, but eventually you have to get from city center to city center. What kind of challenges did you face developing a vehicle that could navigate that type of situation without a driver?
We currently navigate from distribution center to distribution center, which includes surface streets, but most distribution centers built by logistics companies, such as the Postal Service, are located in industrial areas near highways for obvious reasons. It is quite impractical to regularly operate large tractor trailers in city centers themselves. So we tend to avoid that kind of area. So our sweet spot is to be moving from distribution to distribution center that are in industrial areas near highways onto the highway.
If I live in Dallas and a piece of mail comes in my mailbox from Phoenix, will I know that a truck without a driver delivered it?
You will not know. We don't have time to stamp on
them. It might be fun. All right. Chuck Price, Chief Product Officer for Too Simple. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And ahead of the Memorial Day weekend, we want to take note of a young American who did not die on a foreign battlefield, but instead was killed here at home. The Charlotte Observer reports that Riley Howell was posthumously presented two military honors this week, a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Howell was an Army ROTC cadet, and he's credited with sacrificing his own life to save his classmates when a gunman opened fire inside a University of North Carolina classroom on April 30th. Police say Riley pinned down the gunman until they could arrive, and he died from his wounds. Stars and Stripes reports that Marine Corps veteran Thomas Mateo gave Howell's family his medals and said that he was a true hero. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.